This is episode 429, dated Friday, September 12th, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Very glad to be here today with all of you. This is episode 429. Dated Friday, September 12th, 2025. Before we continue, allow me to introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host for today's show, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how are you doing today? Peter, how are you doing today? Oh, Peter.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, Peter.
That was weird. Okay. Anyway, thank you, Bob. Thought I unmuted myself, but I clearly did not. Anyway, we're still in sort of the end of summer, not too much rain yet, but October is coming, and then we hit the rainy season, and it rains from October through, April. But we're supposed to get snow this year, which never happens in Coos Bay, so we'll see what happens.
Is that what the almanac said?
Yeah, basically the long-range forecasters. Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Right. We'll
El Nino or something, so we'll see.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we have the feel of fall today here in southern New England. It's cloudy, but it's cool. Temperature's about 70. It's supposed to warm up a little bit next week, so summer is not quite over. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We have Raymond Gay, our producer and editor. Thank you for your help, as always. Our media sources, I would like to thank them for airing us, because that way we get more listeners to our show. Thank you very much for that. Also, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, who archives our programs on my website. All you have to do to find them is go to www.brancoevents.com, arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will see most of our archived shows from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
And by the way, Peter, she hears that. I asked her. She hears that all the time.
I heard, yeah, she sent a nice email. I think you forwarded it to me. She appreciates that. So
yes, I know.
I'm glad you like it, Jackie. We thank you for what you're doing.
Yes, we certainly do. I want to say hi to Trish, our facilitator, and Herbie, who's our streamer for today's program. And because we are streamed live, let me give out my email address for those people who want to write to us about our program. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. Today we are pleased to have Mark Reichert. He is a policy counselor for the blind. And I would like to introduce you, and then I wanted to clarify something before I turn it over to Peter to start the interview off. First of all, welcome, Mark. We're glad to have you.
I really appreciate the invitation to come on and looking forward to our conversation.
So just to clarify, policy counselor is a very, very general title. Could you specify who you are a policy counselor on behalf of?
Right. So my quote unquote day job is with the Overbrook School for the Blind. Overbrook, as the name would suggest, is a school for the blind that's been in existence in this country for almost 200 years. For the last couple of generations, however, Overbrook has an international presence, and yours truly has the privilege of serving as the head of Overbrook's international work. So that's what I do. I smile when I call it my day job because, more often than not, I'm communicating with people on the other side of the planet in Southeast Asia, and particularly where our major presence is, and working with NGOs over there, non-governmental organizations. And I'm on calls in the middle of the night, which means now that I'm middle-aged, I value the opportunity to nap for a little bit during the day, for sure. So it's really more my night job, not a day job, if you will. But the short answer to your question, Bob, is I still get to, because of the flexibility of my schedule and the timing of it and all, I'm so pleased that the work that I've done for many years prior to this job for primarily the American Foundation for the Blind, but several other organizations, including for about 25 minutes as staff to the American Council of the Blind a long, long time ago, I'm still doing some volunteer work in the education and aging spaces. So pleased to be sort of doing that on a volunteer basis.
Mark, I just want to support your joy of napping, because I am sort of the same way. Sometimes my wife isn't totally enthralled with it, but it's okay. So the reason I wanted to have you on our show, Mark, was because many of folks know you as sort of a policy wonk, policy advocate, done a lot of really good stuff. And of course you continue to do good stuff, but I've heard other interviews where you talk about theology. And you've also talked a little about mental health as well. And I just find all these sort of the nexus between these three areas really interesting. So let's start with the whole advocacy piece. Talk a little bit about what prompts you to get involved with advocacy for blind people and how you think current circumstances might change the way we do business.
Sure. So I don't think anybody at the age of 5 or 6 or 7, when asked the question, so what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, nobody says, I want to grow up to be a middle-aged overweight policy hack. That's really what I want to do. You don't start out that way. You sort of end up here, I think. What I did want to do when I was a younger person, high school and college, et cetera, I knew that I wanted to possibly teach at the college level, either political science or sociology, you know, that kind of stuff, sort of what makes groups or societies tick and operate. And then I took a course called Law and Society in college with a professor at Stetson University, my undergrad, he's gone now, of course, but his name was T. Wayne Bailey. And Dr. Bailey was very much involved in Florida politics and all of that. He was a member of the Democratic Party, of course, and was a delegate to many conventions and so forth. And the course that he taught was all about basically looking at, you know, U.S. jurisprudence, particularly Supreme Court precedent, but very practical. You know, we learned a lot, but it was also very much linked up with a review of the current events at the time as those various decisions were made. It's just a very dynamic course. And all of a sudden, the switch got thrown in me of, gee, teaching is lovely, but wouldn't it be also great if you could be part of something where you get your hands dirty, and really get in to pull levers and push buttons and work with people to actually make some things happen, not just reviewing history, but making it. I'm hoping that as this giant helicopter goes by that I don't sound like I'm on an episode of MASH here. Hopefully you can't hear that. I apologize. It's here loud. Got my windows open. In any case, so went off to law school, got out of law school. I've told the story, won't recount it in detail here, about the struggle there for about a year and a half after law school, really struggling to find work and putting up for the first time my experience of feeling like I have a disability. Never been ashamed of being blind. I guess I would use the word proud of that aspect of me, but I never really thought of myself as having a feeling disabled in that sense. And boy, you go on a bunch of interviews and hear the reactions you hear, and you get a bit of a taste of the real world there. But thanks to networks of folk and one gentleman in particular whose name I'll name drop, Scott Marshall, a lot of people know him, but others got networked up with my first professional gig at National Industries for the Blind, which is essentially the trade association, if you will, for in private and public industries for the blind, programs across the country. And that was the beginning, of getting, I was their government affairs representative there. And I really just frankly got addicted to the policy process. So that was the beginning of that whole thing. And over the course of my career, I've done, about 30 years or so working, as I said, with a number of organizations of and for the blind. Also then serving, as the executive director of the Blindness Fields Professional Association. So I've had a lot of different experiences there. And what has changed now? I will tell you, and I think others who have done this crazy work for a very, very long time, I don't know anybody who has been doing this for 25 or more years like I have, and some people in our field have done it for a lot longer, who would say that who would disagree with what I'm about to say, which is it really isn't fun anymore. There was definitely a time when, for those of us who are nerds, policy hacks, whatever you want to call us, you know, we're working, and sure, you'd have tough fights, and you know, there'd be lots of disappointments. And it, by definition, the policy world or legislative or policy process is slow. It's meant to be slow. It frustrates people. And frankly, that frustration has boiled over in this country such that people don't want to embrace the slowness of policy change. And I think that's such a corrosive thing, because as frustrating as it is, the alternative is quickly made policy is poor policy, and quickly made policy is often divisive and not based on consensus, because it is the consensus and the incrementalism of it that drives people bananas. But that's what preserves, as conservative, small c now, as conservative as that overall approach is, it definitely preserves the framework of government and society. And slowness and sluggishness also means stability.
I just want to make one comment before I turn it back over to Peter. You talked about the slowness and the frustration that a lot of people feel about it. Mm. Some people call that bureaucracy.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And depending on your point of view, it may very well be a good thing. I mean, nobody likes red tape. But on the other hand, if you're coming along with a machete to slice the red tape, you know, the whole thing about red tape, it was, you know, they bound up all of the documents. I think it was from one of the wars, and, you know, the records that were kept, to document people's service in, wars. I think it was either the Civil War or maybe the Spanish-American War. Anyway, it goes back a long way. And they bound up all of these records in literally red tape. So yeah, you slice that red tape open, you're going to have paperwork going all over the place. And some people may like that. And like anything else, pendulums swing. You know, we go far in one direction, perhaps we go farther in another. My only point is that, for at least for now, is that I'd say the major difference between, you know, if you want to say then and now, certainly when I started, and I expect it probably was happening before then, There was a funness. I might have just invented a new word, a joy in doing the policy work that is largely absent now. And that's really tough. And I think there's a lot of dynamics more we can talk about there, but that's really the fundamental difference. And what does that mean, Peter, to finally get to the punchline of your question? I mean, for us, there's a lot of things, of course, a lot of fights that we're fighting now that were never really quote unquote on the agenda, things that we thought were sort of settled. And there's a lot of things now that are clearly unsettled or being questioned, you know, foundational kinds of things. So that you're having to refight those things that we thought were sort of settled policy and law and practice, which means that it's harder than to push an affirmative policy agenda. You know, maybe we should update our American special education law, or maybe we ought to be doing a lot more for older people with vision loss. And how can we do that in a creative way that minimizes bureaucracy, but also, better directs federal and state funding? And, that's where I'll wrap it up, Peter, is to say, the major change moving forward, I think a lot of us who've been doing this a very long time recognize that, I'll just point the finger back at me. I mean, I've always sort of had this knee-jerk reaction, oh, there ought to be a law, and we ought to do it at the federal level. Clearly, there's an interest to do more at the state level on some folks' part. And there is also a concern about that, because, of course, the states are often ill-equipped to handle a lot of the things that affect those of us who are blind or visually impaired because of the small size of our population, the complexity of the solutions we often try to that we need to benefit from. And of course, the funding to support the programs and services, particularly for kids or folks in the voc rehab system or the independent living system. And states just individually really struggle, with handling that. And which is why our field has pushed for many years for federal or national solutions, not because we have this craving to expand the federal government or reach, you know, have Washington do a top-down control, but because states were ill-equipped to do it. And I'm not so sure that they're any better equipped today, perhaps even worse so because of the burden of economic burdens they face.
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'm not going to do it right now because I want to sort of pivot. You talk about joy. And one of the things that, if you look at religions in particular and Christianity in specifically is the concept of joy, the joy of the Lord, you know, the joy of being together, you know, all that stuff. And so I'd like you to sort of take us on your faith journey. My understanding is you started off in the Missouri Assented Lutheran Church. Sort of talk about your, and maybe how that connects with the advocacy work you do. Talk about sort of your faith journey.
Yeah, I love this question. So joy, as soon as you mentioned that, so I think of writers like C.S. Lewis and the Inklings for, you know, for fellow writers, Tolkien and others who, for them, the word joy is almost a term of art. And we could really noodle on that idea for a while, but I would encourage people if they're interested to sort of Google that and start as a springboard off on other things because it's very interesting and I think it's very fulfilling, but right. Joy is not glee. It's not happiness. It's not jumping up and down with joy bells ringing. It's a sort of deep inner peace, that maybe you don't even necessarily, it's not a feeling. It's an orientation or many better words we can use, because heaven knows, I mean, I've certainly had my, dark days. I think a lot of people do. I would assume everybody does to one degree or another. But even in the midst of those times, there's a sort of deep inner core. It doesn't mean that the outer, shell doesn't get cracked and scarred and cracked open on occasion. And that, and the outer shell can hurt, but you do have a deep core. At least I feel that with me. Feel again, not being the right word, but you get the picture. When did my faith journey
too deeply down this rabbit hole, but your comment reminded me of, you know, there's so many people who have, died, for their faith or for their beliefs.
Yeah.
And, as they're preparing for their death or as they're suffering, whatever, they somehow find this inner joy, which I just find really, inspiring sometimes. And it's sort of hard to understand. And, I think part of it is, of course, you know, if you're spiritual, it's the Lord who gives it to us. But I also think it's something, as you said, that's practiced.
I think, to be super expansive in this conversation, you know, you think about, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Plato, you know, where are you? You are when you're right in the spot where you need to be, or you find that you're in that spot where you really need to be, even if it's in the fire. Fire is hurting. You're going to scream. On the other hand, there is a sense of this is where I am to be. And there's a centering, about that. Is it the Quakers, I think, that used the expression of peace at the center? I mean, there is that thing. So anyhow,
I took you down the wrong path.
No, so you're fine.
If you want the path I want you to go down, talk about your faith journey.
Yeah. So, I mean, being a good Lutheran boy or not so good Lutheran boy, depending on how you look at it, I would say my faith journey began on July 6, 1969, when I got baptized in Southern Florida. My parents attended one of the, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod affiliated congregations down there. The LCMS being one of the two primary, major. I mean, there's other many smaller, I don't want to call them factional, but you know what I mean? Smaller branches of American Lutheranism, but LCMS, I think would be considered the second largest of the main, Lutheran communities in America and certainly known for being more conservative. In fact, when I first got my hands on a legislative database, when I worked at National Industries for the Blind, you know, you could look up members of Congress. You could do this today, of course, so much more readily than you could even back then. But the tools were still sophisticated enough. You know, you could do research on all the members of Congress and put in various, you know, how many of them are married, which ones are single, which ones are this, that. And of course, they had religious affiliation. Not that everyone listed it, but most did. And it was fascinating. Even in 1994, when I first check this out. Lutheran members of Congress, the Republicans were all Lutheran Church Missouri Synod affiliated of the Lutheran members of Congress. The Democrats were all Evangelical Lutheran Church in America or ELCA affiliated.
Imagine Lutherans. That.
And no flip. I mean, I was so fascinated, but I took the list and went through. Nope. No crossovers. I don't know how many.
And that's not a coincidence, right?
Oh, I mean, of course not. There's no question. I mean, whether it's, you know, we're not going to get into a theological debate here today necessarily, though, of course, I'm always up for a good thumb wrestle. But I would say, you know, theologically speaking, politically speaking, on the issues of the day, it just is a fascinating thing to when you do that comparison. So I bring that up not just to try to show off that little memory, but to say, you know, my upbringing was very much a conservative Lutheran upbringing, which is still very, very important to me. I would say if I had to, I really don't have a lot of identity things going on with me. If I do, I guess I would say, you know, child of the living God first and foremost. And beyond that, I mean, sure, I'm proud of to have that Lutheran heritage, but I don't think in sort of tribal terms, and I certainly don't think of tribal terms as Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative. If I were forced to pick up the lanyards on the table, you know, pick and put ribbons on them like you do at a conference to say who you are, then I guess I would say I'm pretty theologically conservative and socially more liberal or centrist. I don't see myself as being, some issues I would guess I would consider myself progressive, I think. My mother might say very well think that, I'm very liberal, but that I think reflects her orientation. Then it might be then maybe others would. But so faith journey, I mean, I grew up in the church. It's very important to me. I think like a lot of young people, I did sort of wander off to find where demons dwell, right? In the college and law school years. And then as you get older and go through life experiences, again, it's that notion from scripture, bring up a child in the way in which he will go, right? And he'll stay there. I've totally mangled that verse, but you get the idea.
He'll come back to it essentially.
Yeah. And so, yeah. I mean, I think, it's a grounding for me. There was a period in my life, where I was very seriously considering, becoming ordained. I don't know that I ever thought that I would do straight up parish ministry. I thought perhaps maybe I might again, teach at seminary, something like that, because it's certainly a personal, passion, interest, joy, of mine. And, but you know, it's now at this stage of my life, I feel very, settled about things. And for me, the biggest thing is the questions, right? Being open to the questions, to find a way to, think more expansively about trusting that the scripture is where you find the word of God, how you approach that, how you let it speak to you, and coming at that notion in a way that you're open to what I truly believe is the case when you look at the scripture. There's a lot of clarity there, but there's also an awful lot of plurality of opinion, even built in to scripture, such that we don't have one gospel, we have four. In the Hebrew Bible, or what we call the Old Testament, you have at least three, I think, versions of even something as clear as the Ten Commandments. Scholars would suggest that the first five books of the Bible weren't written just by one person, but by groups of people, the so-called documentary hypothesis, which is a little dated, but, and whether you believe that or not, or you think that's all nonsense, or maybe even think that that's heresy, I would say even if one were to be able to prove that Moses wrote every word of those first five books, what he preserved, if he indeed wrote them all, were different approaches at different times. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, the New Testament dynamic of seeing Paul and Peter quarreling, over all kinds of things. The apostles themselves holding a conference in Jerusalem about what to do to welcome Gentile members. I mean, what you see over and over again are people drawn together by God with common values and a willingness to come together, but who are expected, commanded to work together in a dynamic that is pluralistic. And I think there's a lot to be learned just from that lesson, that unanimity, yes, we are to be one, but that oneness is not necessarily a oneness of we're not all thinking the same. That the unity is in, frankly, much probably deeper, more profound things than a particular answer to a particular question at a particular moment in time.
So I'm really intrigued by sort of your reading of, you know, one and, well, sort of e pluribus unum, which is not quite what you're saying, but it's right. Kind of, you know, you're, yes, we're together, but yet we have to work through issues in certain ways. And I can't help but wonder how that has influenced the way you advocate.
I think it's influenced it a lot. And I think it makes me popular with some people and it makes me reviled by other people. I mean, I honestly think, when you're the person who, in spite of, I mean, look, I have very strong personal feelings about any number of things that go on in blindness policy and politics. And I don't hold a lot of heretical views, but I would definitely hold a few that if people knew exactly how I felt about this program or that particular program, you know, they would say, well, clearly Riker's not a team player. Gee, if we had known that about him, maybe we wouldn't have had him. We wouldn't have hired him. But the reason why I keep those to myself is because I've done that work professionally. When you're a professional, and particularly I've never represented any of these people formally as their, you know, attorney of record. I have a license, I'm admitted to the Florida bar, but I've never practiced law in my life. It's always been sort of this policy work. And, but you know, they tell you, it's drilled into you. When you're a lawyer, you're going to be a zealous advocate for your client. You don't have to agree with them. It's a profession. Your job is to provide the best possible representation for them and to do it with zeal and conviction. And if you can't, then you'd better step away from that because you have an ethical obligation to do it. So when you say influence my approach to things, yeah, I have always been one to try to not swoop into a situation and say, I have the answer that you people have never, or you're too stupid to have thought of it. Here it is. And you need to do it my way. And I've also never been the one to come in and say, okay, there are two or three or four sides represented at this table. So I'm going to pick one, or, you know, it's either I'm representing a particular point of view. And so I do that, or which has been more the case, especially now during these volunteer days in the last 5, 6, 7 or so years. Where I'm sort of the person trying to essentially staff a coalition or try to bring it together. And that is super, super tough. And you have to recognize that it's a plurality of views sitting at that table. And that by definition, consensus is going to mean that, you know, if you do it well, most people are going to be unhappy because most people are going to get a little bit of something, but not everything, which means they're going to be unhappy, particularly with the person who, from their point of view, made them come to consensus and compromise what the hell they wanted to do in the first place. And that's a very, very tough position. And I don't know, you know, hopefully my skin is a little thicker than now than it's been years ago, but I still have pretty thin skin about things and, you know, comments that people make definitely can sting for sure. Sometimes they cut really deep, but I'm settled with the idea of because I know that consensus is the most important thing. That's how you get to a point where you're ready to move forward with something, you know, that's new, that is agreeable to enough people such that, you know, gee, this would make good policy. And it reflects generally the consent of the people who you're trying to work with. But it's very difficult because you leave that, let's say you do two or three of those meetings a day. The first meeting in the morning, you got half of the people liking you and the other half can't stand you. Now and that's talking about one set of issues. You go to the meeting in the afternoon, a lot of the same players are there, but now it's a different issue entirely. And now you're working through that and trying to bring consensus there. And all of a sudden the people who thought you were a real jerk in the morning might very well think, well, gee, record's on our side now in this meeting. So it's very tough. So yeah, I do think that you're right. I think that sense of there are lots of different points of view. If you're going to do this sort of stuff, I say professionally, I mean, no one's paying me to do it these days, but which is fine because I got a paid job. But it's that recognition. I think, you know, it's a commitment to a process where you say consensus is really, really important. And you have to be willing sometimes to get kicked around in it because people generally do not like to give up things that they want. And it's a hard thing to manage.
So Mark, I want to, it seems to me that where we are now, sort of politically, the old ways of doing business aren't as effective. You've already said this, aren't as effective. And I wonder if some of those heretical views that you talk about and that we all have to be talked about. Because, you know, the world's not going to come back to the way things were 6 months ago. That ain't going to happen. Whatever we thought about the world 6 months ago, or let's say 9 months ago, I think it's pretty clear it's not going to come back. Yeah. So it seems to me we need to recalibrate what we believe, how things should get done. And I'm wondering, you know, if perhaps we should be more, heretical in a respectful way, of course, because we need to rethink the way we advocate or things we want or how we get there. Strategy. Talk to me about how you react to what I've just said.
Yeah, I love it because I think, and I've tried to do this. I'm not the only one, but I've tried to do this over the course of time too, where, you know, planning various conferences, let's say at the American Foundation for the Blind or other places, to literally say, let's not just have a panel of talking heads and get people together to talk about how we should all get along. If I have to go to another panel about how we should all get along, or gee, we all really need to just put aside our differences, and we should all get along because, you know, just imagine if we all got along, or, you know, the differences among the blindness organizations, if we get, just imagine what we could accomplish. It frankly, and forgive the crudity, but it's just a damn lie. I mean, the simple truth of it is 80 to 90% of the things, the various global sort of issues. Are we in agreement? You better believe it. Are there other differences? You better believe that too. And those differences, sure, they do involve very sort of, you know, they're political with a small p, or even personality or attitudinal based, and sometimes can get very, very personal. For sure, that's been the case in the blindness biz, you know, for a long time and still is in a lot of ways. But the truth is there are good, solid reasons for why there are differences. And to talk about this as though, gee, if we could only eliminate those differences, we could get so much more done. The truth is our little field punches well above our weight historically. I mean, we have gotten a lot of pretty impressive things done. And I'm forever grateful, maybe not so humble, but grateful that I've had a chance to have my little fingerprints on a lot of them. And I think it's good to be proud of those things. We should celebrate them. Our community has done a lot. So to suggest that, gee whiz, we should subordinate the individual points of view that where there may be fissures between the organizations or different philosophies of blindness or whatever, we should minimize that. Because if we only could, we'd actually be able to get some amazing things done. We have gotten amazing things done. And that they're not 50%, it's not 50-50 agreement, disagreement. It's overwhelming consensus. But there are critical differences. I mean, a pet project of mine, of course, has been in the special education area, the so-called Cogswell-Macy bill. That thing is never going to see a president's signature on it at all. But what you want to do is use something like a bill like that to be a catalyst for a discussion and to harvest provisions of it when the time eventually comes, hopefully in my lifetime, where we're actually going
to... Could you explain what that bill is for those who don't know?
Oh, well, right. So, I mean, the bottom line is, it's a collaboration, has been a collaboration between blindness, deafness, and deaf blindness to agree to a set of provisions that would, amending the national special education law known as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. And, it's an enormous bill. I mean, it's meant to be a comprehensive. It would be, if enacted, would be the most comprehensive update to the special education law for our three communities, you know, the so-called sensory disabilities community, since the national law was put in place in 50 years ago, 1975. And so, you know, you look at that, and most of the organizations in the blindness field have supported it over the 10 years this bill has been around. The National Federation of the Blind doesn't support it for a lot of reasons. Principal among them is that they believe that somehow the legislation, because it's advocating for including protections and advantages for children who may benefit from low vision devices and services, that somehow that's going to undermine or rip the rug out from the commitment we've all made to make Braille the provision of Braille instruction and the use of Braille a default for blind kids. And I mean, it's just, in my view, fundamental misinterpretation. Frankly, I think it's an intentional one, to take that attitude, but it's a difference of opinion. I strongly disagree with them. Is it reasonable for them to have an opinion? Not only might it be reasonable, they have a right to have an opinion that's different. And rather than sitting around talking about, you know, gee, we should just shut them up or go for what the majority wants, or worse than that, which frankly is happening these days now, where some organizations have said, you know, of all the things we're working on, we don't need to, you know, first of all, that bill ain't going anywhere. The NFP doesn't support it. What we really need to do is, find a way for all of us to work together for things that we actually do think we're going to move forward. And so let's, you know, come on, let's compromise with the NFP on this. The simple truth of it is, I think that would be a denial of the fundamentals. Don't worry about the provisions of this crazy bill. It's the notion that we're not going to be inclusive, or that we're going to suggest we're going to fight for the rights of kids for Braille, but because we're concerned that doing so, trying to promote low vision services and devices is somehow going to undermine that we're going to deny kids their right to low vision devices and services. It's just crazy. That's not a principle I don't believe we can compromise on. But now
I want to do one quick thing before we go to questions, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about sort of where you are spiritually now, just in broad terms. What do you go to church? What church do you go to? Where are you these days?
Well, so I've talked about this in other podcasts at some length. So I went through a real sort of, you know, bleak period there where I really kind of went down into a dark sort of depressive hole there for a while for a whole host of sort of situational reasons. And when that was the case, I lived at my mother's, little condo there, whatever you want to call it, her little apartment, in Florida for, about 10, 12, 13 months or so. And while there, I kind of got reconnected with her church down there. She lives in a Lutheran retirement community, just outside of Orlando. And as a result of that, now, she certainly still attends there. And their services are broadcast, via the internet and so forth. So I quote unquote go to church now with my mother, there. But, it's like so many things in our lives. How many things are virtual that we frankly now sort of take for granted? And this is how we live our lives in a lot of ways. But for me, it's not unlike the way my work situation has played out where, And with the volunteer work that I'm doing, I honestly don't know the difference between, daytime and nighttime, the work week, the weekend. I was joking with a friend of mine the other day, you know, I know what day it is in principle. Thank God somebody named the days, because if it weren't for that, I mean, I really wouldn't be able to distinguish one from another. Now it's all become so blend since I work from home.
Yeah.
And all of that. So. I do spend an awful lot of time, with, either podcasts or reading for sure. Certainly not only scripture, but also, commentary on scripture and other things. And music's a very big thing with me. I took 13 years of classical piano, training. Now I just do it for fun, basically improvisational stuff on my own.
Mark, I was going to say the weekend is coming up. I'm just being a little humorous here. The weekend is not tomorrow.
It's good to know, you know, but tomorrow and Sunday aren't going to feel much different for me. I'll wrap it up by just saying I'll invoke, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, right? Who used to say, Sabbath, it's important to honor the Sabbath, but the Sabbath is really a cathedral in time, was his expression, which I just think that's a beautiful feeling. And it's really that state that you enter into where, you know, it's a period of rest and rejuvenation and it's not confined to a specific day. And I love that idea.
Before we turn our festivities over to our participants and our other listeners that we have listening right now, I just want to make a quick observation about your reference to Braille for children. I hope it's not UEB. I'm not fond of it.
Well, fortunately, that's a level of detail that the bill definitely does not get into. You know, the federal legislation is super, super general. But the serious answer to your question is, we simply affirm in the Macy bill the primacy of Braille. And all we're doing is trying to make sure that parents who advocate for their kids have all the tools in the toolbox that they need, including if that kiddo has a lot of usable vision, that kid should be able to have access to the highest quality low vision devices and services right alongside Braille to make sure that kid can be as effective as possible.
For those who don't know, UEB is a new Braille that was founded about 14 years ago or so, maybe 12 or 13, having to do with unified symbolage, dealing with computers. It's technical, it's complex, and frankly, it don't even look right. The optics are not there sometimes. So I can get into a whole show about UEB. I don't want to do that now. What's more important right now is to turn our show over to the participants. You're listening to In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco, and he's Peter Altschul, and our guest is Mark Reichert, Policy Counselor for the Blind. So, Trish, do we have any hands raised at this particular time?
At this particular time, we do not.
Okay.
Okay, when that happens, just let us know.
Oh, you just got one.
Oh, okay.
Let's take it.
All right. Stacy Smith, go ahead.
All right, Stacy, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I just wanted to say that, a lot of things I agree with what you said, some things I do not. I happen to think that, on a lot of things we can agree, on some things we cannot, but it doesn't bother me as much as you think, I say that, that UEB stuff, I agree with you on that. I don't like it, but I have to deal with it daily. I'm a UEB user because I sort of been forced into it. I have a Braille Sense 6 and I've had to use the UEB because it's around and, I've had to use it for all sorts of things from Braille magazines, to Braille books, to, a lot of things. It just is. And it's been around for some time. And
well, look at it this way, Stacy. If you've known print for 50 years and all of a sudden you're told you have to read print differently, that shouldn't happen. We should continue to do what we've done for 50 plus years.
Well, I would agree, except that it won't work with the computers. That's the problem. It won't work with the computers. And, second thing is, I think that, as you might know, as you might understand, if even Jesus didn't agree that we could all be saved in, 10,000 different ways. So I hate to say that, but that's the case. And
do you have any questions for Mark Reichert?
Well, it's interesting your background and like I said, I can agree with some things. I can't agree with others. That was my only comment.
Yeah, and Peter, you asked a question earlier, which I went down one of my little digressions there, whatever avenues. Let me get to the punchline, which is, I've tried over the years to encourage different organizations to do this, which is literally program in time on conference agendas for debates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where you literally have, if it's not one-on-one, maybe it's two or three people, but don't just give us another panel of people saying, gee, if we can only get along. That's fine. And I don't want to be stirring up disagreement for the sake of disagreement. But I do think creating a space where we are intentionally bringing people together to debate out an issue where it's prepared and well thought out, people who bring the evidence to that conversation with supporting data, and that it's not simply turned over. Sometimes people want to have things devolve into, let's have an open mic and we'll just let people debate that way. And you know what? I don't want to be seeming to be anti-democratic, but I think part of the challenge that we have in this country is that we have gone so far to the extreme of basically saying we want to encourage all people to express themselves, and therefore any opinion, no matter how unsupported or without any data, is welcome and should be celebrated. As I'm not one of these people who rails against postmodernism and, you know, truth is only your own truth and all that, but I think there is such a thing as truth. I think it's very sometimes difficult for a mere mortal flawed human being to find it. And I know that's true for me. And I know that it can be colored by our, you know, personal biases and passions and all the rest of that. But there is truth. And I think we have an obligation to try to seek it. It should be done in a way that is informed. And I think if we did, like you say, Peter, we all, I'm sure each of us have our little heretical views, as it were. And I think if we found a way to build in a professional, measured, but nevertheless candid, regular debate of issues that says, you know what, no cow is too sacred, or whatever would be a more appropriate thing to say, I think that would do us a world of good. At least I would hope it would.
And what I would say, I think we need to, I don't want to get too deep into this rabbit hole either, but I do think we need to take a step further back. I don't know if we have a common vision. You know, without a vision, people perish.
Well,
I think the problem is I would love it if we could come up with some kind of vision that would sort of a story. You know, we may have had a story about what it meant to be blind in 1963. I don't think that story has been changed since then. And I'm not saying it has to be this, all blind people need to be the same. That's not what I'm saying at all. But it seems to me if we could say, here's what we want. Here are the key things that are important to us. If we can come up with that vision, whatever it looks like, then we're in a better place to have that debate because we all sort of want the same things.
Oh, and yes. And I think, organizations of the blind over the course of many years have not only tried to do that, but have settled on documents, you know, committing that idea to writing. It is my understanding that the current group of blindness organizations may very well be trying to put something like that out again. But I will tell you, if my fearless forecast, and no, this is not a negative commentary on any of the people who are doing it now, because I was one of those people back then and I tried my little heart out too. You do the best with what you have. But I would say, The thing that those kind of statements often suffer from are an abundance of platitudes, very little specifics, but most importantly, a refusal to do exactly what you said earlier, which is to really confront challenging issues head on, which is to say, I don't want to see another statement that says on the education of blind kids, all kids deserve have a right to this. And, you know, we want to, of course they do. Who's going to disagree with that? The issue is, how do you intend to implement it? And no, a vision document can't settle on all those particulars. You leave that for other stages, for sure. But I do think it would be critical to have that kind of visioning concept, but one that is, you know, a little less platitudinous, or whatever the right word is, and more concrete steps.
I'm going to say one more thing about this, and I'm going to move on. I think viewing vision a slightly different way. I'm viewing vision as a story.
Yeah. Sure. A narrative.
I agree with you. I think vision statements aren't very valuable. Yeah. But if we could come up with a story, you know, once upon a time, you know, whatever, and we all sort of liked the story, then I think we're in a better place to have those debates because we're going for the same direction.
Yeah. And in point of fact, the people who need to tell that story are largely not at our table.
That's right.
Because if you look at the population and truly look at the population, my dear sweet 85-year-old mother is with every day with her lessening whatever, vision. Eventually she's going to be formally able to say she's a person with low vision.
Mm-hmm.
People like my mother they're not going to identify as being capital B blind ever. My mother wouldn't, even though she has an only child who's totally blind, and and my mother's completely comfortable with it. So being able to tell a story that's honest and truly, I don't want to use the word inclusive because people light up with that, but that is, you know, that captures who the royal we are. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. In a lot of ways, our field has really stacked the deck over the course of time.
Yeah.
Our issues reflect the group of people we have at our table who are members of our organizations. And those are critical issues, not even sort of saying they're not. But let me tell you something. That's a minority experience of the population, certainly in America, who's living with vision loss. These are people who don't identify as our people, may never do that. And the solutions they need are not ones that we necessarily have been traditionally offering.
Chris, do we have any hands raised?
Any hands up?
I do not see any hands.
All right, okay.
Well, that changes. Please,
hang on.
All right. All you gotta Nigel, do is tell them there's a vacancy.
I know, yeah, and then they come right up. Nigel has his hand up.
Let's take it.
Hello, Nigel. Brother Nigel. Hello.
You need to unmute Nigel.
Nigel from Florida.
He's unmuted.
Nigel from Florida.
Has a similar last name than you do, Mark.
He's yes. Reichert. Yeah, he was no more than about a mile or two away from me when I was
He's
growing
Reichert,
up.
He's Reichert, and you're Reichert. He's got an S, you don't.
Nigel, go ahead. You need to unmute.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
Am I audible at this point? I just want to thank Mark. Brother. Brothers doing great. Brethren. Brother Mark, I just want to thank you for, on behalf of the community of those who are blind, for presenting to us this afternoon. Firstly. Secondly, I just want to point out that, yes, Mark and I do share a similar spelling of our surnames. Is R-I-C-H-A-R-T, if I'm correct, Brother Mark. And I am R-I-C-A-R-D-S. Similar, but different.
Right.
Also want to point out that Mark and I, we rode the same school bus together. Although I was a few years ahead of him. Excuse me. Let me be grammatically correct. I see we have another hand, so I won't be too long. I just want to point out that, we shared the same TVI at the elementary school level. And we went to the same school at the, elementary school level, at least for me, it was the fifth grade. I was only at Nova Elementary for 1 year. Anyway, also, I am so glad to find out. I didn't know that we were brothers in Christ, Brother Mark. And, that is great. What else do I want to say? I guess that's about it. I want to point out that, when we had that MASH moment, we did not actually hear the helicopter, but thank you for telling us what it was that was causing your audio to change. I don't know whether the background noise suppression came from Zoom or if it was your mic. But either way, anytime anything like that happens, it's just a defunct audio. That's all it turned out to be.
Okay, very good.
No real helicopter.
So I want to say I know both of you vaguely. I don't know either one of you especially well, but I've heard both of you speak in different ways. I think we should get both of you on to talk about theology. I think it makes for a fascinating discussion because I think the two of you agree on certain things and may not agree on other things. And I think it might make for a very interesting conversation.
Totally, totally. I'm up.
Sign me up.
I can sign me up.
Let's do it.
You can.
Let's do it.
Oh,
I think it'll be fascinating. Thank you, Mark. Both of you, but Mark. The person who just
Brother
got
Nigel.
On the air after, Nigel. Sorry,
a former guest, by the way.
I know. Yeah. I know. Sorry, it's the last names that are the same, not the first. Not the first name.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So Nigel, Reichert. Thank you. And I think Nigel and Mark will make for an interesting conversation.
That'd be great.
So let's think about that.
Let's do it. That'd be fun.
Trish, I think we have another hand.
We did, but they lowered it. It was a phone number. There it is. Okay, area code 575, go ahead.
Yes, I'm Beth from New Mexico. And,
yes, Beth, it's been a while. How you doing?
I do agree with some of the things you say, and I don't agree with some of the things. For instance, education of blind children. Well, I'm another one. I don't like UEB. I hate it. I resent it that I have to use it. I resent it big time.
I put up with it. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
I
was mainstreamed in public in Catholic school, and I liked my Catholic education, but I hated being the only blind kid in school. And I will say that at least I learned how to fight like a boy.
And something tells me that you still can, from the tone of your voice, and good for you. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, because I don't think that the schools, I don't think public schools really cared about the bullying then, and I know they don't, seems like they don't really care about it now either, and I would like to see, I don't know, I didn't mind the schools for the blind. I would like to see those that wanted to go there, and those that didn't want to could go to public school. And also, I would like to see better education of blind kids and voc rehab and stuff like that. Like some of the poorer states can't do as much as some of the states that have more resources.
I think we need to be a lot clearer. Beth's comment reminded me of that, about what it is we want out of voc rehab. What are the four or five, this is sneaking up, what are the four or five things that are the most important that we want blind folks, you know, or maybe it's 10. I don't care what the number is.
We got about two minutes, guys.
But I think we need to focus on what is it that's really important to
us. Well, thank you.
So thank you, Beth.
Thanks, Beth.
I made my...
See, you guys, Bob and Peter, we could do a whole series of calls on education. We could do a whole series of calls on what we need. I mean, the voc rehab system needs some help, and for sure, because there's a sort of staleness, I think, in the attitudes about what to do about that. And apropos of everything else we've said up until now about debates and different points of view and the money and where's the money and how are we doing it? I think, quite frankly, we've spent so much time historically in the blindness system defending the voc rehab system from attacks from people who say, well, we just need to give it down to the local level, or we need to privatize the whole thing or everything else. Our field has largely just dug in to try to defend voc rehab instead of trying to find a way to improve it, as if somehow pushing for improvements is an acknowledgement that it's not perfect. Yes. And gee, if we do that, then we're opening up ourselves up for further attack. And I find it really frustrating about this, Mark.
I know we're running out of time.
And we are out of time.
Yeah, we are.
Then I will say what's really frustrating. We'll have to bring that up another time.
You say it next time he comes back, Peter.
That's right.
Because we want to have you back along with Brother Nigel. With or without him, we want to have you back. It's been a great show.
Let's do it.
And we can do 10 shows on this topic. I really am feeling that's possible.
Yeah, for sure.
Easily.
Mark, thank you. Mark Reichardt, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, Peter. Trish, Herbie, everybody else. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. I'm Bob Branco. See you next week.